Senator Begich, I'm on.
Thank you, Senator Begich. This is Senator Wilson, and we'd like to welcome everyone to the Senate Hess Committee. Today is Thursday, March 31st, 2022. We're meeting in the Butchovich Room. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. We gaveled in at 1:35 p.m. Committee members present are Senator Reinbolt, Senator Costello, and myself here in Juneau. And then we online, we also are joined by Senator Hughes and Senator Begich. We do have a quorum here to conduct business here in Juneau. Folks on the phone can vote for adoption and amendments, but we will not be passing any piece of legislation out today. So today we will consider our first item of business that we have is adopting a CS and considering amendments to SB 175, Healthcare Services by Telehealth, by my office, and then we'll look and then we'll hear a introduction and take invited testimony and public testimony on HB 184, Require Child Health Care Compact, and then we'll see where we go from there at the end of the committee. So we are starting with, actually we'll take a brief at ease. We are back on the record. We have a motion, Senator Costello.
Mr. Chair, I move the Senate Health and Social Services Committee substitute for Senate Bill 175, version 32-LS1421/Gulf before the committee as our working document.
All right, and I'll object so we can get the summary of changes on the record. And on Teams, we have one of our Committee 8 staff, Ms. Jasmine Martin, to walk us through the version I to version G. Ms. Martin.
Hello, thank you.
And Ms. Martin,
can everyone hear me?
No, you're coming in all robotic. Would you like to try to just kill your video and see if that helps with the connectivity?
How about now?
You want to reintroduce yourself and we'll see from there.
For the record, Jasmine Martin.
No. You're still robotic. That's fine. I'll just go ahead and go through the summary of changes that committee members have. We have six changes from version I to version G. The first one is the ability to dispense and administer Botox via telehealth is removed. That is on page 2, line 21. The second change in the language is regarding Medicaid services in section 4 is cleaned up. So on page 5, line 24 and 25, this removes the ability to use fax as a way of telehealth to be able to bill Medicaid. Page 5, line 5 and 6, removes the federal waivers and demonstrations and added a separate line for services under control of federal waivers and demonstrations other than community and home-based services. And page 5, line 17, deleted the Community Health Aid Program Certification Board and replaced it with a certifying entity for behavioral health professionals in the state specified by department regulations, just to do some cleanup language, and so that they don't have to keep having these things a statute, but it's just done by regulatory authority. Third change talks about the language regarding prescribing via telehealth for our Alaska APRNs. It's tightened and clarifies that the prescribing powers for nurse practitioners on page 2, lines 25, is added if the advanced practice of registered nurse complies with the statute AS08.68.710 and adds a new section, section 3, that does not exist in version I, that creates a new section under Title 8, Chapter 68, under Nursing, defining the telehealth prescriptive authority for the advanced practice registered nurse in statute. This section aligns with the regulatory authority of the Board of Nursing and with the State Medical Board regarding prescription of controlled substances by telehealth. The fourth change was added to require all applicable licenses, boards, and the Department of Health to adopt the regulations necessary to implement sections 3 through 6 of the Act, including Medicaid provisions, no later than June 30th of 2023. This is under the new section 11 that adds a language of detail this adds a language to the detail of when each entity must adopt regulations, and adds a new effective date in section 11 that takes effect immediately. The fifth change was added a 7-year sunset to the Medicaid pay parity. This is a new section 6 and new section 7, and the new effective date of June 30th of 2030. The sunset languages relating to the Medicaid pay parity for telehealth. And the sixth major change was due to the bifurcation taking place. We had to update all our bills, and this language now refers to the Department of Health instead of the Department of Health and Social Services. And those are the six substantive law changes that the CS went through. And with that, is there any further objection to adopting the CS or questions for explanation of changes for the CS?
Senator Wilson?
Yes, Senator Baggage.
Just a simple question. And were these changes worked out with the department and with the sponsor?
The departments are nodding their head yes in the audience, and I am the sponsor of this piece of legislation, so yes. I hope I worked it out with myself.
Of course, you never know.
Yes, Senator Baggage.
Mr. Chair, this is Shelley. I have a question.
Yes, Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you. I just want to understand Medicaid pay parity, what that is all about, and the sunset date. I'm not familiar with what we're talking about there.
Yes, Senator Hughes, this is something that we talked about, was trying to find a compromise in terms of pay parity, including so the telehealth can have the same payment system as in-person for the first 7 years of this piece of legislation. And that would expire, so it would not go into perpetuity to allow these entities to be able to recoup. That was some of the best practice knowledge that we looked at in terms of how we need to allow pay parity not to go on in perpetuity, but finding a way to work with the different stakeholders and coming up with a compromise to this situation.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Hughes.
So 7 years is quite a long time. I thought we were talking about a shorter amount of time for non-Medicaid. Is there some reason why it's 7 years as opposed to 3 or 4 years?
We looked at a way of time because your first 2 years, we're still going to go through the regulatory process of having the department set rates for some of these items, and that process, in my experience, has taken up to 2 years to come through, and the department is shaking their head to that statement of yes. And if you like, we can put them on the record to talk about that if you would like, Senator Hughes.
Well, before we do that, my understanding, and you and I both come from a background of working on these issues pre-legislature years for our service, and that is what Medicaid does often sets the tone for other insurers. And what I'm concerned about is the high cost of care statewide and for our budget, to be frank as well, and that the sooner we can see some savings, because we know telehealth is less expensive, and originally we allowed it so that the clinics could get their software set up, the technology set up to do this. And there was not the thought that it would take that long. And so Alaskans are hurting as far as cost. And so I am concerned that we're just pushing out when we can start realizing the savings for this, not just for the Medicaid population and the state budget, but actually for the other Alaskans who are insured through the private sector. So could you as a sponsor address that? And can you provide me any assurance that in the private sector insurance realm that we could start seeing savings before 7 years? And then if you want to bring the department up about the 7 years, I would like to hear that, because I'm kind of disappointed that it is that long.
Yeah, Senator Hughes, we provided an article that came to us in terms of the research on this from NCSL. We sort of asked them to look into this as well about best practices and pay parity across the nation. And I believe that was sent out when we had this. I know it was a few weeks ago we sent this bill out to folks. But we will resend that information out about some of the pay parity issues. We did not allow pay parity during the time of the emergency disaster that was stripped out of the bill. And I think that was SB 56 at the time. And that bill, that we did that on the Senate floor before it went over to the other body. And research have shown that a lot of entities do not wish to engage in telehealth, and it's more profitable for certain practices to continue to practice in person, and they do not encourage that practice. But we will ask the department to come up and talk about how they perceive a 7-year sunset.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, DHSS. The department had several conversations with Chair Wilson, as well as the House sponsor of this bill, and we did express some concern. I don't think we had a strong feeling on the number of years. We understood the desire to allow the infrastructure to be stood up for telehealth. When we talk about pay parity, currently the department for Medicaid does pay the same for a telehealth visit as if it was an in-person visit. But when we are looking ahead at continuing to modernize the Medicaid program in terms of moving away from fee-for-service to value-based payments, things like managed care, bundled payments, et cetera, we express that it would be helpful if that limitation of paying the same for in-person versus telehealth did not exist into perpetuity. So I believe what the chair expressed, that doing some research, he came up with a reasonable compromise for the department.
Senator Hughes?
Okay, well, I still am concerned that that's more time, because telehealth actually in many clinics across the state started more than 10 years ago as far as being set up for it. So to allow time for the infrastructure and to make the adjustment, I think 7 years is too long. And I don't know if you as the sponsor would entertain shortening that time, but I won't stop the bill because of it. I'm just concerned. I think that healthcare costs are one of the major problems we have right now in our state.
And so this is something that we were trying to also work out with the other companion sponsor of this piece of legislation, as it looks like their bill will be the final vehicle, as they are further along in the process than this piece of legislation that we have before us. And so we're hoping to marry these two up in the next committee of referral is our best guess on how that may work if it does not go to finance committee. Right now it's just labor and commerce is next committee of referral for this piece of legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. With that, any other comments before we adopt the CS and go to amendments? All right, seeing none, we'll go ahead and adopt version G for SB 175, which brings us to the amendment process. And we have amendment number 1 by Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 1.
Object for explanation, Senator Reinbold.
Thank you. This is on page 1, line 9, and we're just deleting without and inserting after. I just think it's very important that, as I made a promise, I told you guys a long time ago that I was going to do everything I could to protect the physicians in Alaska, and so this is just with an in-person visit first, and then they can have telemedicine after that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you, Senator Reinbold. I think that the purpose of the previous versions of this bill was the intent of trying to have those folks that may have established network care that may have happened out of state or coming here first, but we're just trying to allow the continuation of just expanding the telehealth with all Alaskans. And so this would still have to be an Alaskan provider, but still have to be practiced in the scope within the state of Alaska. I believe that some of our CS changes. Maybe we'll ask Director Chambers to come up and talk about some of the changes of that was made in this is the second CS.
Thank you, Chair Wilson, members of the committee. For the record, Sarah Chambers, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. And there have been quite a few changes between this version and the House version, so I would be happy to talk about the rationale for the way version G is written, if that would be helpful.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So the version G, as it's written, using the word without, it reinforces what's currently in much of our healthcare providers' individual statutes within Title VIII, and sometimes not even mentioned in statute, but the boards have had the opportunity to adopt regulations regarding telehealth and allowing telehealth to occur without an in-person visit first. And as the chairman stated, this also reinforces current practice for products like Teladoc, for example, to be able to provide health care from licensed providers who are licensed in Alaska but may not be physically in Alaska to provide care as they do right now to Alaskans. And so, for example, Teladoc, who is a large healthcare provider utilizing Alaska licensed physicians, is part of our state employee health network right now. And so without allows them to do that, and adopting the amendment with the word after would mean that they could no longer practice in Alaska. They would have to physically be located in Alaska in order to conduct any kind of healthcare relationship with an Alaska resident. Hopefully that's helpful going between the different amendments.
Yes, thank you. So the doctors can.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, before.
Can I get in the queue, please?
Yes, Senator Hughes. So physicians still have to be licensed within our state of Alaska.
Yes.
To practice medicine through telehealth.
Yes, Chair Wilson, it's illegal right now unless you're practicing under a specific carve-out like a Indian Health Service or military position. You must have an Alaska license in order to practice.
Thank you. Senator Hughes?
Yes, and I just want to say I'm going to go back to the healthcare cost thing, and because right now, I love our in-state Alaskan physicians and providers, so I'm going to get that very clear on the record. But I'm also concerned when the providers up here are charging 100, 200, 300% more than they are out of state. And I actually want to introduce competition. So I'm going to be opposing this amendment because I think that a telehealth provider that might be helpful to someone from out of state, and there might not even be someone with that kind of specialty training in the state as well, that I don't want to inhibit that. And again, I love our in-state providers, but I do believe that that the healthcare cost situation has become so severe that we cannot we should not be trying to stop Alaskans from seeking more affordable care. So I'm going to be opposing this amendment for that reason.
Thank you. Any further debate on amendment number one? Seeing none, Senator Reinbold.
Okay, so I made a promise years ago when I worked with Representative Vasquez on the telehealth bill, and I made a commitment to Alaska physicians that I would never undercut them. This amendment keeps the promise that I made years ago. And basically, just reading what it says right now, a healthcare provider other than a physician licensed in another state may provide healthcare service within the healthcare provider's authorized scope practice to a patient in this state, so in Alaska, through telehealth, without first conducting an inpatient visit. To me, it was just very important, even if the physician was able to do some sort of a referral or something under their care prerogative. I just truly believe that if we have all these doctors that are moving up here and they want to treat Alaskans, and then we're doing telemedicine, and you miss so much. It is so important. I used to work in a medical clinic for years, and I was the chief operating officer of a Medical Park Family Care, and I also helped manage a hospital through the business office. And to me, that inpatient care, you learn so much more seeing that patient, talking to him, communicating, rather than the coldness of telehealth medicine. So to me, it's really, really important to protect the healthcare workers in the state of Alaska, and that's why I would urge a yes support. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, and I missed Senator Costello, so we'll let you have one more last word on your wrap-up, Senator Reinbold. I'm sorry, Sandra Casella.
Thank you, and I just want to point out on page 3 that if a patient on lines 2 through 5, if a patient chooses not to receive the health care through the telehealth, that they are not forced to do that, so it's not requiring that. And I think Senator Reinbold brings up some good points, but I think that it leaves it up to the patient to decide, and so I really like that part of the bill.
Yes, Senator Reinbold.
And with that, Alaska, it's very expensive to move up here to set up a practice, to pay off your medical benefit, all your medical school and all that. And I just think it's shameful to have them then, you know, just make a little phone call out of state and get care. So with that, I'm gonna keep my amendment before us. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. With that, we'll take a roll call vote on amendment number 1. Senator Baggage?
No.
Senator Hughes?
No.
Senator
Costello?
No.
Senator Reinbold?
Yes.
Senator Wilson?
No. 1 yea, 4 nays. Amendment number 1 fails. We're on to amendment number 2. Senator Casella.
Yes. Just for sake of clarity, the way the bill is written, that if the out-of-state medical doctor has provides telehealth to a patient in the state, there has to be an established relationship, and they have to have previously conducted a physical examination. So the way I read this bill, you're not able to have out-of-state doctors working alone without a connection either to the patient or in Alaska, a licensed physician. So you can't just have somebody calling up and having a telehealth appointment with no, you know, from out of state with no pre-existing relationship. Am I correct in that?
No, and I think Sarah, Director Chambers, might be able to explain that. And I think that's similar to what we have is our Alaska Care Plan. She was explaining the teledoc. So all our members that are under Alaska Care currently now, without having an existing relationship, can just call Teladoc up on their number that you get as a little card in the mail, and that's part of our services that are – but those practicing physicians or healthcare providers are licensed within our state. And
that's not my question.
Oh, but yeah, sorry.
So I'm talking about – I'm sorry, through the chair. I'm talking about medical professionals licensed outside the state of Alaska. The way I read this bill, that in order for that person outside the state of Alaska to provide healthcare services within their scope of practice, that the physician and patient have an established relationship, the physician has previously conducted a physical examination of the person.
Through the chair, this is Sarah Chambers. Through the chair, Senator Costello. Yes, that section of this bill creates a carve-out that doesn't currently exist that would allow these physicians who are not licensed in Alaska to, under these conditions stated, as you read, to deliver telehealth. Currently, They can be a physician who is physically in another state but is licensed in Alaska.
All right. So, yes, yeah, sorry about that, Senator Cassell. Follow up?
I have another question.
Senator Bramble.
Okay, so sometimes we get really caught up in specific things, but I've made a commitment, and I really want to keep the commitment that I made. So it says a healthcare provider, doesn't say who that is. It just says a healthcare provider other than a physician licensed in another state may provide healthcare service within the healthcare provider's authorized scope of practice to a patient in the state through telehealth without first conducting an in-person visit. It doesn't say in another state. I'm just worried. Could it this be international potentially as well? I'm trying to, because this is extraordinarily broad. And now I not only have it concerned that it's potentially a physician licensed in another state, it actually says a healthcare provider, which is even a bigger red flag for me. And now I'm wondering if it's literally could be any healthcare provider internationally.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I had exactly the same concerns that you did the first time I read the bill, and after reading it a few times, came to discern that the definition of healthcare provider is on page 3, line 7, and these are all persons who are licensed in the state of Alaska. So the phrase healthcare provider in section 1, line 6, points to a person practicing any of these listed professions who holds an Alaska license. So if someone, just as it is now, someone who lives outside of Alaska or travels outside of Alaska, even internationally, could provide telehealth as long as they're in good standing in Alaska with their Alaska license. So it is much narrower than the initial first reading, and I had the same impression that you did.
And before that, we're going to take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. We have a second amendment. Senator Reinbold.
I move amendment number 2.
Object, Senator Reinbold.
So this is on page 10, following line 17. Insert a new subsection. Nothing in this section authorizes an individual employed by an entity permitted to write a telehealth under the section to prescribe, dispense, or administer telehealth with a controlled substance listed in AS. Dot, 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 dot. And then. And then we relettered things accordingly.
All right. Any discussion on amendment number 2?
Yes, I have a comment.
All right. We're going to go to Senator Costello, then Senator Hughes.
Oh, go ahead and take it.
Oh, Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we have to be really careful with controlled substances, and that's why we have that designation. However, I had a conversation with my daughter, who's a physician, who just prescribed through telehealth a controlled substance, and it would have been unethical for her not to provide the needed treatment for her female patient. So and it was in a rural situation where it would taken a couple of hours to drive to come in person, and the person's health actually was such that would not have been in the best interest of the patient. So I am going to be opposing this amendment.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Baggage.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar to what Senator Hughes has just observed, that especially in rural Alaska, you know, allowing a telehealth provider to prescribe means that the patient would only need to meet with one in-person provider, and the second could be via telehealth. This really places an undue burden, this amendment, on folks who might not be able to access an additional in-person provider for the services. So I for the very same reason, recognizing the caution on opioids, but recognizing the importance of ethical duty, I'm going to be opposing this amendment.
Thank you, Senator Baggage. Any other discussion on amendment number two? Seeing none, that Senator Reinbold, close out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the opioid crises, I just think it's really, really important to try to get a handle on controlled substances and being able to try to prescribe these from somebody out of state on telehealth, I think is actually kind of alarming. I really think that it does require an inpatient visit, and I truly believe it should be under the care of a physician when it's something so strong. Under controlled substances are controlled for a doggone good reason. And if you look at SB 124 and then you put SB 175 on top of it, I mean, I'm sorry, there's just tremendous opportunity for somebody from outside even administering psychotropic drugs. And it concerns me. I'm just trying to prevent a problem that I see potentially happening in the future. And with that, I urge a yes vote.
All right. Thank you. With that, we'll take a roll call vote. Senator DeHughes?
No.
No. Yes.
Senator Baggage? No. With one yay and four nays, amendment number two fails. And with that, we will set Senate Bill 175 aside. And before we take it at ease, I will ask that maybe the Department of Director Chambers a question on the PDMP, and it doesn't have to be on the record. You can just, if you can provide a statement to our office, we can disseminate just on how the PDMP would work with telehealth and prescribing controlled substances, so we can get that out to the members before we bring this bill back up before us again. And we'll take an at ease as we transition to our next item of business, which is House Bill 184. We are back at on the record. Now before us, we have House Bill 184, Require Tribal Child Welfare Compact. My Representative Zukowski is here at the table with her trustee staff, Katie Giorgino. As she said, I have to use the hand motions as you pronounce her name. The floor is yours if you want to place yourself on the record, and please proceed.
Great. Thank you so much, Chair Wilson and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, Tiffany Zulkowski from House District 38, representing Bethel and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta.
And Katie Giorgio, staff to Rep. Zulkowski.
It is my privilege today to present House Bill 184 before the committee. House Bill 184 is a short, straightforward bill that seeks to protect implementation of the historic and landmark Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact by codifying it in Alaska statute. As many of us know all too well, OCS is burdened with high rates of staff turnover, and its caseworkers have carried caseloads at more than three times the national average, despite relatively recent efforts by both of our bodies to address that issue. Additionally, Alaska Native children make up roughly 15% of the state's general population of children, but represent over 60% of the children in state custody. Plainly, this disparity represents a system failure in our child welfare system. An agreement between the state and 18 tribal co-signers representing 161 federally recognized tribes, the Tribal Child Welfare Compact offers the state systematic innovation to provide services and care that every child deserves. Regardless of political ideology, there are elements of this policy we can all embrace. If fully implemented, it stands to save the state millions of dollars over time and transform a struggling child welfare system through cutting-edge law and policy. These are values that I hope we can all agree on. Tribes, the state, and invited stakeholders have been working collaboratively on child welfare issues for over 25 years through a tribal-state collaboration group. The goals are to strengthen Alaska's compliance with the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978, reduce the disproportionality of Alaska Native children in state custody, and build and strengthen the relationships between different stakeholder groups. Additionally, tribal Title IV-E agreements provide tribes with a higher federal reimbursement rate than states for services including foster care, guardianship assistance, and adoption assistance. This means tribal-state partnerships can leverage increased federal funding and save state dollars. The Government-to-Government Tribal Child Welfare Compact aims to improve outcomes for Alaska's children and families by transferring specific negotiated services and supports from OCS to the tribal co-signers. The historic agreement was signed at AFN in 2017 by Governor Walker and was continued in 2019 under Governor Dunleavy. Please keep in mind, the compact does not transfer jurisdiction of the child to the tribe. That remains solely with the state. Through the compact, tribes are better positioned than OCS to focus on prevention and early intervention strategies for vulnerable families. In 2018, tribes began developing programs, building capacity, and developing infrastructure to support the state's mission. By 2019, tribes continued developing capacity and negotiated expanded scopes of work, but the continuance of the work was paused following a change in administration. Tribes and OCS have been fortunate to have the support of Governors Walker and Dunleavy, but because it is not in statute and it is currently an executive initiative, this adds significant ambiguity for the important work that's done under the compact. Since then, however, tribes and the state have negotiated their differences and come to an agreement on the previous and expanded scopes of work, which include initial diligent relative searches, ongoing relative searches, family contact, licensing assists, and safety evaluations. In 2021, additional funding was made available for preventative services. And then, as you can see, negotiations for the compact are set for April of this year. Tribes are able to provide higher quality services closer to home for children and families, and at a lower cost to the state by leveraging tribal resources, reach, and infrastructure. Continued commitment to this compact will improve outcomes and better serve our young people and families in the foster care system. The compact also strengthens essential services by engaging and empowering our most local governments, and families are often more likely to engage in work with their tribes than they may with the state. Finally, as we know, the experiences children have during their formative years have a disproportionate impact on the lives that they will go on to lead. Adverse childhood experiences lead to chronic health problems, mental illness, substance abuse later in life, and increased incarceration rates. I would like to underscore how costly ACEs are, and the research is clear, that if we do not invest in healthy families and healthy children early, we will pay much more down the road. Now, if you like a brief sectional analysis, you're going to love this particular sectional analysis. This is a one-section bill amending AS 47.05 to add a new section to Article 1,
requiring the state to participate in a tribal child welfare compact. So in closing, you might be asking, why House Bill 184? As of now, the Tribal Child Welfare Compact is an executive initiative. Tribes and OCS, as I mentioned earlier, have been fortunate to have the support of Governors Walker and Dunleavy, but House Bill 184 looks to provide a firm anchor in state law for the ongoing implementation of the compact with zero fiscal impact. This bill provides co-signers with stability and predictability so they can administer quality programs to vulnerable youth and families in the most remote parts of the state without having to worry about whether the compact will continue to be around in the future. I know in our line of work, we hear a lot of numbers and statistics, and while this generally leads to good policy, it provides distance between the decisions that we make and the consequential effects those decisions have on the families that we represent. And that is why this compact and this bill are so exciting for me. The Tribal Child Welfare Compact is not just a positive step in the state's relationship with our tribal partners, it's an incredibly innovative and forward-thinking policy that reaches children and families in a meaningful way that we would not be able to otherwise. Mr. Chair, again, Guyana, for the opportunity to present today. I am happy to make myself available for questions from the committee. We also do have several expert testifiers on the line who can probably offer invited testimony that may answer some questions.
All right, thank you. And for the committee, we also have the Director of Office of Children's Services on the phone, Kim Guy, and we also have Deputy Commissioner Clinton Lastly on the phone as well to answer committee questions. We'll go to Senator Reinbold, then Senator Costello, and then we'll check with folks online.
Thank you very much. So I have three questions. First of all, I want to make a comment. I do think OCS, I've heard more complaints about OCS under COVID than I've ever heard before. So I do think child welfare is a problem and an issue, and I'm personally seeking solutions. So with that in mind, I want you guys to understand that I am open-minded in regards to this. But what I'm a little bit wondering is, on one of the slides it said there was 161 tribes, but in the other presentation that we saw on 123, there was 229 tribes. So where's the discrepancy with that 70 or so tribes?
Sure. So to answer your question through the chair, again, for the record, Representative Zelkowski, through the chair, Senator Reinbold, yes, there are 229 federally recognized tribes in Alaska. This particular initiative is a state and tribal compact. And so essentially, the state and the tribes that are co-signers are signing on in an agreement to provide specific scopes of work. So as you see in the bottom bullet of this particular slide, there are 18 tribal co-signers that represent 161 of the 229 federally recognized tribes in Alaska. So of the 229 federally recognized tribes, roughly 161 of them have entered into this compact in an agreement to provide the specific negotiated scopes of work.
Senator?
I have two more questions. So in regards to the tribe, I understand it's all executive orders, basically, or executive agreements or whatever, and the legislature's not involved, and I think that's your purpose of coming today. So what I'm wondering is, how is a tribe identified in Alaska? Is it a bloodline? And we kind of went over this a little bit with 123, but one of your testifiers may be able, but I'm sure you can identify this as well. But how is a tribe identified? Do they have to be an Alaska resident? Do they have to be a citizen of the United States? Is it a percent bloodline?
Thank you for the question again, Representative Zelkowski, for the record, through the chair. If possible, I would prefer to defer that question. We have Nicole Borromeo on the line, who is an attorney who could be more of an expert in answering that question during her invited testimony.
Okay. We can get that to when we get to invited testimony. Yes, and I think the question, maybe for the general counsel there for AFN, would better be, it's how membership of tribes are established. I think each tribe is a little different, but I think that's trying to repackage or frame your question to hopefully get the answer that you're looking for, Senator. But Senator Reinbold.
And I have a third question, Mr. Chairman. So my third question is, if the kids of those 161 tribes, is this in the state of Alaska, or is this, I don't know, I don't understand tribal issues as well as I would like to learn more, but if, are these tribes in other states as well, or is it just Alaska, or would, like, I'm sure you could potentially have tribal members in another state, and that's why the first question predicated the second, so maybe the invited testimony, but I just want to know if this just impacting children in Alaska, or could this be more of a United States, you know, or even broader potentially issue.
Thank you for the question. Again, for the record, Representative Zukoski through the chair, Senator Reinbold. The Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact is a negotiated agreement between Alaska's federally recognized tribes and the state of Alaska with respect to particular work being done through the Office of Children's Services. And so, as I mentioned, regardless of the work of the compact, the jurisdiction over the child remains with the state. What the tribes are doing are leveraging their existing resources and relationships to offer support to OCS in diligent relative searches, ongoing relative searches, family contacts, licensing assists, and safety evaluations. And I think our invited testimony will be able to answer the questions about the scope of that and why that came to be.
Can I just make a comment to you about that? So the reason why this is important, I went and I'm doing due diligence. I even met with a lawyer in regards to SB 123, and I'm really trying to understand, you know, the impacts of these, of the legislation in real life. There was a family that they were part of a tribe. They were in Massachusetts. The woman decided to divorce her husband. She decided to come back and work under tribal law or tribal issues. And there was a huge dispute jurisdictionally. It ended up where they lost in that, and they ended up going having to go back and actually have the child custody issues taken care of in Massachusetts. But those are the kind of things I'm just trying to understand and the impacts of what the legislation is, if it has to be resident of Alaska or if it's, you know, a tribal that's more of a fluid definition. So I think I'll learn a lot from the invited testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Casella.
Thank you. And my first two questions were actually identical to Senator Reinbold's. I was wondering, I also heard a discrepancy in the number of tribes, and so you answered that question. And then also I had a question about how the tribal membership is defined and what that looks like. I'm also curious about the number of children who've been helped through the compact in the past and what communities they're in.
Great. For the record, Representative Zelkowski through the chair, Senator Costello. The invited testimony that we have online, so Nicole Borromeo is the general counsel for AFN, but she also has been integral in the negotiations between the state and tribes. But we also have two tribal co-signers that are available today to be able to talk about the type of support that they've been able to provide to families. And to just clarify, in terms of the scope of this compact, while I understand there might be questions related to jurisdiction, and I know we also have Kim Gui on the line from the Office of Children's Services, to be clear, the jurisdiction of the child in state custody remains with the state. So the Tribal Child Welfare Compact is really looking to leverage support in helping to do diligent relative searches and all of the work surrounding that, but the custody of the child remains with the state.
Thank you, Senator Casella. Follow up.
Thank you. And yes, my question had to do with where the children are located and the number of children, not necessarily the scope of the help. And so I look forward to that question. So what this bill does is that it requires the state to participate in a compact. And usually a compact is government to government. And so in the past, the compact has been something that the executive branch initiates with the tribes. And my question has to do with whether or not this violates any kind of balance of powers between the legislative branch and the executive branch, because what we're doing is we're basically forcing something that we've already been doing, that's already working, that's been very successful. And so I was wondering if somebody can answer that, because if we allow for this, then what would keep the legislature then from forcing the executive branch to enter into compacts in other areas where it takes away the power of the executive branch to make that, dilutes the power, I think, of the executive branch, if the legislative branch is doing it in this way. And I think the reason that we're putting this in statute is because this program can't exist without the governor's office. And so we're moving it down into a different branch of government and saying, rather than putting the program in statute, which I imagine you are not able to do because it's a compact. So if I could maybe have somebody respond to that.
Yes.
So for the record, Representative Zilkowski, through the chair, Senator Costello, I can speak to part of that. And what I'll speak to is the intent of House Bill 184. The intent of the House bill is really to protect and provide clarity about the expectation that this is an opportunity for the state to continue exploring in terms of the state and tribal relations as it relates to the compact. To be clear, there's nothing within House Bill 184 that compels the state to certain negotiations or to certain agreements or to certain funding levels. All of those negotiated scopes of work, the negotiated funding agreements that accompany those are all left at the discretion of the state and the tribes. What I've sought to do through House Bill 184 is to protect this systematic innovation by codifying it in statute. If this committee believes that there are other ways to provide clarity and ensuring that we can protect the good work of the compact without running into any constitutional issues, I'm available to have those discussions and would consider amendments to do so.
Thank you. We'll check with the folks online. Senator Hughes, do you have any questions for the bill sponsor at this time?
I'm just wondering, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, Representative Kosky, as far as the success and data that you have from what's been going on, are we seeing improvements that this is an effort that is worth continuing? I understand the premise behind it. I'm just wondering what the data is showing. Thank you.
For the record, Representative Zilkowski through the chair, Senator Hughes, thank you so much for that question. If I could just ask for a lifeline for my invited testimony to be able to more adequately address that, I would ask for that.
Yeah, do you know which one?
I think Nicole Baromeo is probably a great place to start.
So, Nicole, I want you to keep a little parking lot list. When we get to your invited testimony, we can hopefully get to answer that question. I just don't want to keep going back and forth, and we'll start with her invited testimony here in a moment. Do you have another question, Senator Hughes?
No, that plan sounds good to me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Begich, do you have any questions for the bill sponsor?
Just one quick one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the bill, you use the directive language, shall enter into agreements. Yeah, could you just explain why that's necessary to the committee?
Sure. For the record, Representative Zilkowski through the chair, Senator Begich. Again, from our perspective, in terms of the intent of the language, we wanted to codify the certainty and expectation and ensure the clearest language that that this shall continue. Again, the intent of it being to protect the continuance of the good work being done. But again, as I mentioned in a question earlier to Senator Costello, if there are any concerns related to that, I'd be happy to engage with dialogue with members of the committee.
If I could follow up.
Yes, Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My feeling about that was that the shall language really is saying if a compact is fairly negotiated between the Department of the State and otherwise, that the state has to adhere to it, which I think is the intent, which to me is good intent, but is that a fair understanding, or should I defer that to Attorney Baromeo?
For the record, Representative Zilkowski through the chair, Senator Begich, yes, the intent again was in any compact, the state and the tribes need to go through negotiations every year. And typically that looks, and I guess in plain language, it's essentially doing a program evaluation, if you will, to see what's being or what's successful, what maybe needs worked on, as well as negotiating any sort of funding agreements to align with that work. Because the state and tribes have been able to move forward with coming to an agreement on those scopes of work as well as the funding, that was the purpose behind and the intent behind the use of the word shall. But certainly we understand if there are concerns about that. And at the end of the day, the goal is to really codify the innovation that's being done between the state and the tribes by protecting that work in statute.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. It affirms for me the certainty of the bill, which is something I appreciate. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, if no other questions for the bill sponsor, we will go to invited testimony. We'll start first with Nicole Nicole, General Counsel for the Federation of Alaska. She's on Teams. If you would like to go ahead and place yourself on the record and try to answer some of the committee questions that were posed, would be wonderful. Nicole, are you with us? They're on Teams. Oh, you unmuted. Now you're muted. Oh, we have lost sound.
Mr.
Chair. Hmm?
Take an at ease, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, take an at ease. We'll try one more time with Nicole. Are you with us? If not, I don't know if you have the telephone line to call in, but we'll try to go to Tracy McGrary. Tracy, there you are. There's Tracy.
Hi. Yep, I was actually kicked out a little bit ago, so that might have been what happened to Nicole as well. So hopefully she's able to join. I can answer a couple of questions as well, but I'll go ahead and introduce myself for the record. So good afternoon, Chair Wilson and members of the committee. My name is Tracy McGarry, and I am testifying today in support of House Bill 184 on behalf of the three Tribal Compact co-leads and 15 additional co-signers who represent 161 of the 229 Alaska Native tribes throughout the state. I'm also honored to be the director of the Child Advocacy Center and Children and Family Services for Koyaarik in Nome, and I've been in this role for just about 10 years. So Alaska Native tribes know what is best for their children. Alaska Native families and communities are the best places for their children to thrive, and Alaska Native children steeped in the love, values, and cultures of their tribe have the best chance of being healthy, engaged members of society. As you know, the compact is a first-in-the-nation agreement between the state and tribes and tribal organizations to transfer certain negotiated child welfare services and a portion of their associated funding streams to tribes and tribal organizations for them to administer on behalf of the state. The goal of the compact is to rethink and improve child welfare by including and investing in tribes. Codifying the compact into state law ensures that tribes can invest in infrastructure and longevity of staff and not worry about funding being available in the future years. This allows co-signers to focus their work on what is most important to children and families of Alaska. Tribes and tribal organizations have been working alongside of OCS for many years, and the compact, the compact solidifies the commitment of both parties to improve outcomes for all children, native and non-native, that are in state custody. Co-signers have the ability to do efficient and effective child welfare work in children's home communities. Please move House Bill 184 from the committee and adds certainty to the work being done by codifying the compact into state law. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Tracy, for your testimony. Are there any questions for this invited testifier?
Senator Wilson, this is Senator Hughes.
Yes, Senator Hughes.
Yes, I'm wondering if the testifier could speak to, in the 10 years of work and more recently on this, any data as far as improvement in outcomes.
So what we have found, we're still implementing. We just had a training by KC Family Programs, both tribes in the state, on implementation science. So we're working really hard to make sure that the scopes we currently have and are working on are implemented correctly and so the work can be done effectively. So data-wise, I believe Kim Gui can give you more information on that. But I know by listening to the children and families in our community, so foster parents, grandma, grandpas, that being able to take care of their own children is very important to them. And they do not want children in state's custody. And so having the infrastructure support that we are getting from the state through the compact allows us to really do more work on that. So instead of putting out fires, we can do some prevention. And I know with my staff, we're doing those relative searches. We get them right away. And while I don't have specific numbers, I know that we have been able to move children into relative placements sooner than we have had prior to our program anyway, having one specific individual doing that work. And that is due to Compact. I wouldn't have been able to hire that person without that funding.
Follow up, Sandra Hughes.
No, thank you. I'll wait for more on that. It's all about the outcomes of the children. We know it's a tough world right now, and these kids need good help. So I just want to hear more about the successes. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Bagage.
Thank you. I just would reinforce the comments that were just made from the testifier that the certainty really does deal with one of our highest turnover areas of employment. You know, the idea of certainty provides the ability to recruit and retain people, and that retained and recruited relationship in the experience that it entails goes right to the heart of, I think, Senator Hughes' concern, which is the more experience, the more likely you are going to be effective at your service, or at least that's the hope. And so this bill would create a level of certainty that I think it makes sense to pursue and support for that very reason that Senator Hughes brought up. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Bagage. See no other questions. We want to say thank you for this time. We now would like to go to Nicole, who's back online, not on Teams. We're sorry about the technical difficulties. Ms. Bermia, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you. I've got a little bit of an echo because I'm calling in on my cell phone. It won't even let me into Teams anymore. But thank you very much, nonetheless, for having me today. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak with the committee and want to extend a sincere Koyana to Representative Wilkowski for the invite today. I have, as instructed, Mr. Chairman, been taking notes on the questions, so I'm going to run through them in short order because I realize we're short on time and over the time. So if it's okay, I'm just going to jump into this. I can no longer see you guys, so hopefully you can hear me.
Yes, we hear you, and we don't have an echo on our end. If you could speak a little louder and a little closer, and everything should be good.
Okay, absolutely. Is that better?
Yes, just place yourself on the record again and proceed.
Thank you. Nicole Borromeo, I'm the Executive Vice President and General Counsel for the Alaska Federation of Natives, a position I've held since 2014. Since 2017, I have also served as the neutral facilitator for the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact. So I'm not quite sure on any given day what my day job is right now because we're gearing up for FY24 negotiations. I'm spending a lot of time on the compact. And getting to the questions mostly posed by Senator Reinbold, her first question related to how do tribes determine membership. This is a individual case-by-case determination for all of the tribes. In Alaska, we have 229 federally recognized tribes. However, there are 574 federally recognized tribes throughout the nation. Each one of those tribes is an independent sovereign that has its own policies and procedures for determining tribal membership. In the 1970s, the Supreme Court, in the decision Morton versus Moncari, held that how a tribe determines its membership is up to that individual tribe. The federal government will not second-guess tribal enrollment. It is completely up to the tribe. Most tribes do have a eligibility process, if you will, and children are eligible for membership most of the time if their parents are enrolled members of the tribe or if they are eligible for membership in the tribe. Are there any questions?
I just want to make sure that you finish your invited testimony.
Oh, I've not gotten to the other ones that I was taking notes on. I just, since I can't see you, I'm pausing to give Senator Reinbold or Senator Hughes the opportunity for follow-up.
Okay, yeah, Senator Reinbold.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you being on today. So when you said it was a Supreme Court case, and I think I wrote it down, and bottom line, I'm trying to figure out, so can you give us one example of one tribe? Does it have to be a resident? Does it have to be a bloodline? I mean, is there any type of eligibility that you can determine for any tribe?
So there are several different criteria depending on the tribe. A number of tribes do have a blood quantum criteria. However, that was more popular in the early 70s and 80s. A lot of tribes are moving away from that blood quantum requirement now. Some tribes used to also have a geographical requirement, meaning you had to live on the reservation or outside of the reservation in the village in Alaska State, since we don't have reservations with the exception of Metlakatla. But again, a lot of tribes are also moving away from those geographical criteria as well. So those are two criteria, though, that have been traditional. Now, whether or not a tribe still adheres to those is completely up to the individual tribe.
Thank you. Please continue. I think Senator Costello had a question. Yes, Senator Costello.
Thank you. And Nicole, it's nice to have you in committee. I look forward to being back in the district as soon as possible. My question just had to do with what this bill actually does, which is it requires the executive branch to have a compact. And I just was curious if you could respond to, is this something new, and does this mean that the legislative branch has a new avenue over the executive branch, where we can do this in other areas, where we require the executive branch to enter into agreements and enter into compacts, and then finally, does the tribal compact program continue if, you know, without this bill, can it be continued by another executive branch, another governor?
Hi, Senator Costello. I'm looking forward to seeing you back in the district as well. To answer your questions, which also related to Senator Reinbold and I think maybe Senator Hughes' questions about, does this upset the balance in power between the executive branch and the legislative branch? The short answer is no. What this bill does is essentially, if you think about it like the compact is a regulation, you are codifying that regulation. So you're cementing it a little bit more permanently in state law. It makes it easier for future administrations to rely on the ability to move forward with the compact, and it makes it easier for the tribal co-signers to plan around having the compact in existence every year versus being a little unsteady on the ground that they're on. So it doesn't upset the balance of power. And compacts can be authorized by statute just as easy as they can be through executive action. You see that a lot on the federal side with the Indian Self-Determination Act and the compacts that are entered into between Alaska tribal organizations and tribes for healthcare services and the delivery of self-governance related services. So I don't believe that this is doing anything more than making it easier for the state and tribes to administer child welfare services in a manner that is cost-effective and provides higher quality services at a lower cost to the state of Alaska. And then, Ms. Chairman Wilson, there was also a question related to service population and service delivery area that I will take, and then I'll punt the data question to OCS Director Kim Gui, who's on the line, and then Deputy Commissioner Lasley, because they're better positioned to answer that. So to just sum up my testimony today, in terms of what children are served by the compact, it depends on how the tribal cosigner defines its service population and service delivery area. So it is entirely possible that a cosigner could service a child outside of the state of Alaska if that child is enrolled in the tribe or eligible for membership in the tribe, because, again, that would fall under the umbrella of service delivery population, not necessarily the service delivery area, which is generally more tied to the village or region that the tribe or tribal organization operates within.
Thank you. Please proceed with your prepared invited testimony.
Thank you very much, Chairman Wilson. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to yield the floor. A lot of what Representative Volkowski has said was going to be in my invited testimony as well. I just want to close by reiterating the fact that compacts of this nature are completely legal under federal law. They're completely legal under state law. The Alaska State Legislature is not being asked to do anything in this instance that is going to take away from the state of Alaska's jurisdiction over child welfare matters. This is merely meant to improve the administration of children in need of care that are Alaska Native or that are also not Alaska Native if the tribe wants to provide services to that child. But right now that's not happening. Only Alaska Native children are being serviced by the compact. Thank you.
Thank you. Next for invited testimony, we have Vivian. I'm not going to try to pronounce your last name. I don't want to butcher that on the record, but you're from the Associated Village of Council, Association of Village Council Presidents.
Yes, Mr. Chair, sound check. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. If you can place yourself on the record and please proceed with your invited testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, members of the committee. And thank you to Senator Representative Volkowski for inviting me to testify today on the Child Welfare Compact. My name is Vivian Corthius. I serve as the Chief Executive Officer for the Association of Village Council Presidents, calling in from Bethel today. ABCP is the largest tribal consortium in the nation with 56 federally recognized tribes as members. We serve the tribes on the Yukon River, Kuskokwim River, and Bering Sea Coast on the YK Delta. We have approximately 30,000 residents in our region, and today I have prepared comments on the Child Welfare Compact. The Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact is a government-to-government agreement between the state of Alaska and tribes. Tribes agree to perform negotiated child welfare services for tribal children on behalf of the state. Tribes can perform these services in an efficient, effective, and culturally appropriate manner. Because of the high value we place on our children, ABCP's executive board has made a decision to be one of the founding members of the compact, in 2017. I'm going to give you an example of what this means for our region, specifically for child welfare and making a difference in our villages. There are approximately 500 children, tribal children, from the ABCP region in OCS custody. This is the size of a medium-sized village in our region. Half of the children are in homes or facilities outside the YK Delta. That's quite a bill, quite a number of children outside of our region. This number is the size of a smaller village in our region. Being removed from your home, your parents, is a traumatic event in any child's life. Even though it may be necessary to keep a child safe, it is still an additional trauma that children experience. Imagine leaving your home, your house, your parents, everything that you're familiar with, to move into Anchorage or another part of our state. The trauma is now multiplied several times. We count and talk in numbers, but each number, each of those 500 children are people. There was a situation where OCS removed an AVCP member tribe child from their parents in Anchorage. OCS contacted us for help identifying a relative. We found a relative and completed the safety walkthrough of that home. Because of the work of our community and family support specialists, that child was able to move to the relative's home in the village. Because of the compact, there was a process in place for OCS to make that referral, and AVCP received the funding to identify a home and get it approved. This is just one way that we are helping our children through the Child Welfare Compact, and this is why it's so important. We want our children to stay in our communities whenever possible. Another benefit of working with tribes under the compact is the ability to leverage resources. AVCP can leverage other programs we operate to provide potential foster families with the equipment they need to become licensed, make necessary repairs to foster homes, and provide child care resources. In any case, our children are important, our children are needed, and our children are one of our most valuable resources to all the tribes in the region. We support the compact 100%, and we reaffirm with the state's goal for better outcomes of all Alaska's children. In short, we support HB 184 and all its intent. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. At this time, we're going to open public testimony. We do have, looks like, one testifier online, Mr. Storrs. If you could state your name and affiliation and plan a couple minutes for your testimony.
Good afternoon, and for the record, I'm Trevor Storrs, President and CEO of the Alaska Children's Trust, and I'm speaking to you from the land of the Dena'ina people. As the statewide lead organization focused on the prevention of child abuse and neglect, acts in strong support of the Tribal Child Welfare Compact and the effort to ensure its sustainability through the passage of HB 184. Alaska has one of the highest rates of child abuse and neglect in the country. Each year, the Office of Children's Services receives approximately 20,000 calls, of which 45% result in investigation. As shared this year by the department, OCS continually struggles with high turnover rates, most recently reported at 60%. OCS is by nature a reactive agency and does not have the capacity to engage in prevention work with every case that walks through their door. The Tribal Child Welfare Compact represents an initiative, an innovative, I should say, approach to not only strengthen OCS capacity, but allow for culturally appropriate services, supports for Alaska's families within their own communities. Alaska Native children make up 15% of the state's general population, but represent more than 60% of the kids in state custody. The disproportionate number of Alaska Native children in the OCS system must be addressed, and it will take long-term, sustainable, systematic change. That is exactly what the Tribal Child Welfare Compact seeks to accomplish. Over the last 4 years, the compact has allowed tribes and tribal organizations to assist in finding relatives to care for children, visit homes in advance to ensure safe placement, help at-risk families before they need OCS intervention, and work alongside OCS to ensure families have the additional supports they need. This historic, unique compact is working and needs to be made permanent if we're going to move the needle. We urge the committee to support HB 184. Together, and through partnerships like these, we can prevent child abuse and neglect. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Storrs. We appreciate that. Seeing no one else online, is anyone here in the room in Juneau wishing to testify on HB 184? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close public testimony.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Hughes?
Yes, and I really appreciated the testimony. There's one, I think one item, there may be more that's left hanging. I know we're coming up on our time, so if you wanted to move it to another meeting, that's fine. It's just the data. And Vivian's testimony is very compelling as far as children being removed from the world they know and how that would add to the trauma. So I just want to know that this is actually working. So whether you want it, the director of OCS to speak now or at another time, I would like to get that information at some point. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Senator Hughes. And maybe that's something that they can provide the committee in writing. I just don't want to go over our time and be respectful as our room is being filled for folks getting to get set up for the next committee. At this time, we will set this bill aside. I'm not going to set amendment deadline yet, as alleged legal is pretty much at a standstill. We were waiting for amendments up in finance for 2 weeks now, and so we are on the priority list. Not on that priority, as the House is still working on their budget amendments, takes that priority and through working through the prioritization. So we'll try to set, let's go ahead and set a tentative deadline for the 7th, for the 8th. If you have amendments, please try to get them into our committee on the 8th. By close of business, that's Friday, April 8th. And then we will reassess, just depending on hopefully that amendments can be worked on through our alleged legal department. If we need to extend that, we will let the committee know as soon as possible, depending on how fast the turnaround can be for that department. And before we do that, I just want to make sure the representative had any closing comments that she'd like to make.
No, I just, again, would like to thank you, Chair Wilson, as well as members of the committee for hearing the bill today. I think there's an opportunity to protect the good work being done collaboratively between the state and tribes, and appreciate, again, the opportunity to hear the bill.
Okay, thank you. And please work with the department and the bill sponsor for any additional questions. They'll be more than happy to reach out to committee members. On Tuesday the 5th, we will hear HB 62, the marriage witness bill, and hear invited a public testimony by Representative Clayman. And then on Thursday, we will consider the governor's appointment to the Mental Health Trust Board, as well as continue our amendment process on SB 124. And with that, is there any closing comments from committee members? Seeing none, we are adjourned at 3:02 p.m.